Well, we have one of our favorite HealthLink On Air guests joining us this morning. And to take advantage of that fact, we're going to jump right into our conversation with her this morning. I guess a combination of our news and views and a great interview. I'm talking about none other than geriatrician chief of geriatrics, as a matter of fact, professor of medicine at SUNY Upstate, Dr. Sharon Brangman. Good morning, Dr.
Good
Brangman.
Good morning. How are you?
And welcome back. It's been a while since you've been here.
Yep.
Months and months. We're always glad to have you here. And I'm excited because you were just telling me you've got a new elected post to tell us about.
Well, I was elected to be president-elect of the American Geriatric Society, which is our largest professional organization, and it represents over 7,000 healthcare professionals who dedicate their professional careers to taking care of older adults.
That is an amazing, I mean, now, we've known before that you are on the, at least, national stage. I know you've testified before Congress a number of years
right.
ago. And I love the silver tsunami is the term you used, which
right.
I've used now a number of different times. Tell people what the silver tsunami refers
well,
to.
Well, that refers to the wave of older adults that we are just beginning to see. We haven't even peaked yet. And the American Geriatric Society is well poised to help guide the country in directing efforts to take care of these people the best way we can.
And tell us exactly, what is the focus? Is it a medical focus? Is it a policy focus?
Well, it's a little bit of both. For many years, the American Geriatric Society helped to set the standards of medical care for older adults, developing curriculum and guidelines. And we realized that we also needed to have a public policy focus so that we can plan for the older adults that are really here.
You know, many of our listeners and you and I were all a part of this baby boomer, silver tsunami, as you referred to it. I have to think that maybe this is the most important time in history to be the leader of this organization.
Well, there is none other, and it's a huge challenge, but we are not prepared to take care of the baby boomers as they age. And baby boomers have high expectations of how they're going to age, and they want the healthcare community to meet those needs. And we're not ready, and that's one of the things the American Geriatric Society is focused on.
And, you know, it also strikes me, and we're going to get into these conversations, but maybe a theme that runs through all of us, this, we do so much as much as we possibly can to keep people healthy and alive for as long as we can. And then we don't do anything for when they get to that extended age to help them stay healthy. And all of a sudden, it's almost like we hit a wall.
Well, we're a little short-sighted, and we do help prolong life without realizing what those consequences are.
And that's a lot of what we're going to talk about
this
morning.
And that's exactly the issue.
Yes, exactly. All right. Well, we've got a couple of headlines we want to cover first, and this is the news views portion of our program usually, so it's probably a good time to do it. One of them, just a recent announcement, I read it in a number of different places, about a new drug for Alzheimer's disease. Speak to us. I don't even know the name of it. It's a big, long
name. Well, they're not new drugs. These are in a class of drugs that are looking at how the amyloid protein is produced and broken down in our bodies. And amyloid is a protein that kind of gunks up the brain cells mm-hmm. and keeps the brain cells from sending messages and making memories. And that may be one of the key components to developing Alzheimer's disease. So new drugs are looking at how to dissolve those amyloid protein plaques
mm-hmm.
or how to keep them from developing, or to figure out how they're made in the brain and somehow disrupt that pattern.
Well, it struck me when I read these articles that what they said was that this thing was going to eat the proteins, but it always sounds to me like if you're going to do something like that, then there's going to be a problem someplace else.
Well, that's exactly right, and that's why they have not yet been tested completely in humans.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the research has been done on mice and animals. And we also want to look and see what we can do to keep that protein from building up, because by the time it's there, damage has been done. And even if you dissolve it, you're not really taking care of the basic problem.
Ah, so you might dissolve the protein, but you wouldn't get those memories back just because you did?
Exactly.
Ah, very, very interesting. All right. The next steps that they talked about were clinical trials. Are there Alzheimer's drugs in clinical trials now?
Oh, yes. There are a number of drugs in clinical trials, and there's different phases to those trials. And what they want to do is make sure that the drug is safe and the drug is effective, and they need to give it to people with the disease and monitor them very closely. There is nothing on the immediate horizon
that's about
to be released,
mm-hmm.
but there are clinical trials, and some of them are promising, and some of them raise other questions.
They do. Give us a best guess. Are we 2 years from something useful? Are we 10 years from something useful? Can't you even put a number on it?
Well, something useful versus a cure, and mm-hmm. that's always the question. I don't think we're near a cure yet, mm-hmm. but we are gathering more information, and there may be a new drug available in the next 2 to 5 years.
Okay. That sounds promising. And then I would also say, looking at the genetics aspect of all of this, is there work being done genetically to look at people who are at risk? I know I've read some of those kinds of things, but then that also opens up a whole new approach, doesn't it?
Well, the genetics question is very tricky because until you have a cure, I'm not sure if we want to identify a lot of people
with
a genetic risk, especially if we cannot treat them.
You know, that is so true. As the daughter of a mother and a grandmother with Alzheimer's disease, I can absolutely say that's true. I would not go get tested. I don't want to know.
But on the other hand, we want to know what the role genes play so that could be another avenue for treatment.
Absolutely. All right, let's move on to our next Alzheimer's topic. This actually isn't new, but there's a lot more being written about it recently, and that is a tie between Alzheimer's disease and diabetes, and even to the point where I read recently someone is calling Alzheimer's type 3 diabetes.
Yes, that's a very interesting term, and we never really understood the impact diabetes could have on the brain.
Mm-hmm.
But this study was showing that patients who have diabetes have a high rate of developing Alzheimer's disease. But that's not to say that everybody with diabetes will get Alzheimer's disease. And we certainly know that some people with Alzheimer's disease don't have diabetes. So I think it's just opening up another interesting pathway for us to see what are some of the factors that trigger the onset of Alzheimer's disease.
Well, and then further, a study was released recently that talked about patients who have diabetes who, when they get older, they start having low blood sugar moments during the day. I guess the insulin is not working as well as it should. They get into low blood sugar, and the numbers were staggering. I'm going to read you some of the ones I read. Older patients who had one episode of low blood sugar had a 26% greater risk of dementia. Patients with two episodes of lower blood sugar in a day, this is 115% greater risk, and with three or more episodes in a day, 160% risk. I mean, those numbers are just huge.
Well, we know our brains are very sensitive to glucose and they need it to function.
Mm-hmm.
So when the glucose is not getting into the brain, that causes a stress on the system.
It does. If someone has diabetes as a younger person, are there things that they need to be doing about their diabetes to maybe delay the onset or even to prevent themselves from developing Alzheimer's disease?
Well, we don't know specifically yet what that all means. However, the information that we have now is that you want to keep your diabetes under good control.
Which you want to do anyway.
You want to exercise and watch your diet, follow up very closely with your doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, we don't have a clear cause and effect. This raises interesting questions, and hopefully in coming years, we'll know more about it.
And you know, it also strikes me that this kind of discussion lends as much difficult weight to low blood sugar as it does to high blood sugar. Typically, we hear about problems with people with too much sugar, but this almost sounds like the low blood sugar is just as important.
Well, when you have high blood sugar in diabetes, that means the sugar is not getting into the cells.
Mm.
So as far as the brain is concerned, the brain is still not getting glucose.
So you're starving it.
So we still have the same problem. It's just with different levels of sugar in the blood.
Interesting. Very interesting. Luckily, in your own practice as a group, do you find a lot of your Alzheimer's patients have diabetes and vice versa?
Well, diabetes is a major chronic illness in our country, so that there are significant numbers of older people with diabetes, as with hypertension and heart disease and high cholesterol and a lot of the other chronic illnesses that we see.
Uh-huh.
And they all play a role in how our brain functions.
They do, which is a fabulous segue to the next part of our conversation. We're going to take a quick commercial break and come back. When we come back, we want to talk about multimorbidity. We're going to ask you to explain to us what that is and what it means, not just for individual patients, but also for the future of healthcare in the United States and across the world. So listeners, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Dr. Sharon Brangman. This is SUNY Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air on 570 WSYR. Well, Welcome back to HealthLink On Air, produced each week by SUNY Upstate Medical University, making the academic difference in healthcare in the Central New York community. And this is your host, Tricia Torrey, Every Patient's Advocate. I'm here with Dr. Sharon Brangman, Chief of Geriatrics at SUNY Upstate and President-elect, or soon to be elected, President-elect, if I got that right, of the American Geriatric Society. Just before we came to the break, we introduced the word multimorbidity. Dr. Brangman, tell us what that means.
Well, that's the big word that we use in medicine. Morbidity means anything that makes you sick.
Okay.
And that could mean high blood pressure, heart disease, diabetes, arthritis.
Anything that makes you chronically sick or
It could be a short-term illness or it could be a chronic one.
Okay.
And multi means more than one. Mm-hmm. So multimorbidity means a long list of medical illnesses, which is very typical for geriatric patients.
Well, as a matter of fact, we found an article in the New York Times that had an illustration. And if it's okay with you, I'm going to go ahead and read it because I think a lot of listeners are going to hear themselves in this description. Maisie Piccolo has so many health problems, it's hard to keep track. Congestive heart failure makes her short of breath and makes her legs swell. An abnormal heart rhythm raises her risk for stroke. Arthritis in her knees makes it hard for her to get around, and she can no longer drive. She also has osteoporosis and has fallen several times in the past few years, breaking her pelvis. One, on top of all of these medical ailments and others, high cholesterol, high blood pressure, gastric reflux. She has a history of depression, and sometimes it's hard to care for her husband, who's even frailer than she is. Strictly by the book, she should be taking 13 different medications, an expensive, confusing cocktail that has proved too much for her to manage. And on other medications, cause intolerable side effects. And the more drugs she takes, the greater at risk of drug interactions. So what's striking about her predicament is how rare it is and how common. Do you have Maisie Piccolo sitting in your waiting room?
Well, Maisie Piccolo is an excellent example of a typical patient that we would take care of in the office.
A typical. So this is not even an unusual patient.
Not at all. Not at all.
Wow.
And Maisie can also be Mason or Manuel. So this is the stuff of aging.
It is the stuff of aging. How did we get here? Why do we have so many complex problems in one person?
Well, medical science has made huge advances in taking care of problems that may not go away, but can now be managed. You know, just back a generation ago, people did not live this long. They might have died of a heart attack or cancer.
Mm-hmm.
They might have had a very bad infection.
Mm-hmm.
But now we have antibiotics, we have good ways of keeping people alive after a heart attack, and we can manage a lot of cancers. The result is that people are living longer and other body parts start to have problems.
And, you know, it strikes me that a lot of those, as you said, a generation ago, people might have had a heart attack or they might have had cancer, and those were death sentences. Strokes. People didn't survive strokes. They were death sentences just a generation ago. And now what we do is we pull them through them and everybody's greatly relieved. But all it does is set them up actually for even more problems later.
Well, we have to die of something, and that's a pure reality that we can't escape. And we have made great advances in taking care of problems that would have instantly killed people years before. Now they can live with these illnesses. And one of the things that we talk about in geriatrics is that we may not cure, but we always care. So we're helping to care for people who have multiple problems on their medical problem list.
And, you know, it strikes me, there was a term that I heard you use before we started talking this morning, complexivist.
Speak
to me about a complexivist.
Well, that's a term that we've kind of coined to explain what we do in geriatrics, mm-hmm. is that we're taking care of complex people who generally have more than one problem. They're on multiple medications. They may be caring for someone who's just as old and sick as they are. And so that their problems are not simple and quick and easy to take care of. They're very complex. They take a lot of time and thought.
And that takes us to even a different part of the conversation, and that is taking a lot of time. You don't have a lot of time. Now, you know, separate from the whole conversation about the medical aspects of this, we have a health system that tells you you have very little time. And if you don't have much time, and that has to do with reimbursements from insurance and Medicare, if you don't have much time, how on earth can you manage these kinds of complex problems for your patients?
Well, we have to make do, and we have to do it. And one of the things I do is I try to figure out with my patient and their family, what are their main concerns at the visit? and then I try to see if they align with what I think are their main concerns. Sometimes what may not be bothering them at all, I see as a big medical issue that we can't ignore. Mm-hmm. And sometimes their problem is something minor, but it is very significant for them. So we have to kind of negotiate and take care of things in both categories.
Well, let's explain to people why they don't have much time with you. And I know that this isn't a conversation you like to have, so I'll share my perspective, because I like people to understand everybody's perspective in the relationship. And that is that you can't, as a practitioner, you are a business person too. You can't keep your lights on. You can't pay your staff. You can't be there the next time around unless you run that business well. And in order to run that business well, you have a certain number of patients you must see in a day.
Well, I think that our healthcare system has a lot of concerns, and we know that this is on the national agenda. Mm-hmm. And one of them is that the human body doesn't necessarily respond to many of the business models that are currently in place.
That's a very polite way of saying it.
that require doctors and hospitals to run in. Mm-hmm. So I do have to take care of people who have 9 different medical problems. They may be on 13 different pills. Some of those pills may be helping. Some of them may be causing side effects. And I have to figure out how to get this all done in a short period of time, because there are 10 other people waiting for me to take care of them.
Exactly. Now, if you know you have an audience full of Maisies out there, people who do have complex problems, what is the best way they can make use of you as their resource when they come to you? How prepared should they be? What do you want them to do ahead of time?
Well, I think it's helpful if they think about what their concerns are, and mm-hmm. if they come to the office. I love a patient who's organized and has things written down.
Okay.
We may not get through the entire list, but at least we know what's going to be addressed mm-hmm. and what we can put off to the next time if necessary. It's always helpful if they bring all their medications with them.
Right in a bag, throw them
in
all
a bag.
In.
We uh-huh. have people literally coming with a shopping bag full of medications.
Sure.
And those are not just the ones that come from doctors. Those are also the vitamins and the supplements and
right.
things that you buy without a prescription.
Right, exactly right. And when they come to you, if they've got this list, they should prioritize it for you too, according to their needs that they know of?
Well, not necessarily for them to prioritize their list, but for them to have a list so that we can look at it together and figure out which things need to happen in that visit and which things we might be able to delay a little
okay.
bit.
And let's explain to them why you might see things a little bit differently. Some of the things that they have symptoms of, say the knee aches, and that might be arthritis, that would be less compelling to you than something like, say, feeling like their heart is fluttering or maybe their cholesterol
levels
are high?
Well, not necessarily.
Okay.
I don't want to make any general statements right now, because okay. sometimes a knee pain is the main priority.
Uh-huh.
So it really is an individual approach. And I think this article that was in the New York Times hinted on that.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, medicine is in an era where we have all these protocols and ways we're supposed to be taking care of people to try to meet certain standards in an efficient period of time. However, everyone is an individual, mm-hmm. and their problems are unique to them,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes we need to address those in a different way than just kind of go through a list and treat everyone the same way.
All right, now suppose our Maisies come to you, and they've got this list of 9 or 10 different symptoms they're feeling or complaints they have that need to be reviewed, and they've got their bags full of medication, and you have other reasons that you can't spend more than 10 or 15 minutes on that day. They can always make another appointment, can't they?
Right. Well, to tell you the truth, there are very few patients we see in 15 minutes a day.
Okay.
So in our office, we're often running over because we just cannot see patients in 15 minutes.
You can't.
I'm not sure who can. However, yes, we do encourage them to make another appointment, and we take care of that problem then. Sometimes we can start making referrals or get other things organized in another way. We also work as a team with nurse practitioners and physician assistants, and sometimes they're helpful. So there's a lot of things that we can do. That model of 15 minutes is what a lot of physicians have to work with, and it is and sometimes it's not even 15 minutes, it's a lot less.
Mm-hmm.
However, in our practice, we've had a hard time really making that work, because for a 90-year-old person to come in and get all of their problems done in 10 or 15 minutes is really just not possible.
Well, and I hear exactly what you're saying, and I hope the takeaway from our listeners this morning is that as much as you or any other doctor or a provider would want to spend as much time as they possibly could, they can't. So practically the best thing that patients can do is help their doctors partner with them in the very best way.
Exactly.
Very good. Dr. Sharon Brangman, I'm so happy you were here this morning. You're always a font of information for us. Hope you'll join us again more quickly, and good luck at your meeting here in a couple of weeks and your new assignment with the American Geriatric Society.
Thank you very much.
And listeners, it is time to take a break for the news. This is SUNY Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on air on 570 WSYR.